For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to have giving our talk tonight Kogetsu Lori Belzer, who's one of the founders of Ancient Dragon Zengate, is now on our board and is our sewing teacher for sewing Buddha's robe, Roxas, and Okesis. And thank you very much, Hogetsu.
Thank you very much. So I vow to call forth as much as I am able of love, of respect, and of faith to remove all obstructing defilements and to clear away all the taints, to listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas taught for the wheel of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So, good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
Anybody recognize those lines? No cheating.
That sounds familiar, but I forget which.
Okay. It was just a pop quiz. Not really. So I might repeat these words a lot over the next part of my lifetime. So that is the opening verse of the verse commentary on the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, which is one of the earliest of our Mahayana sutras. So I'll say, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. So already, you know, this is like the Buddha's getting ready to give some kind of, you know, wonderful teaching on the amazing interconnectedness of all beings. And still starts out with this invocation. You know, arise in your hearts this kind of bodhicitta. You know, it's rare that I see love written in the sutras. But this is Kanza's translation. And then it goes on, you know. Next order of business is to remove all the obstructing defilements and clear away all the taints. That's a pretty tall order. And also, like, what is that taintedness, defiled? I'm not tainted or defiled, you know. But in Buddhism, you know, the concept of purity isn't that you're better than someone else, but it's a giving up, and even I would say a composting of all of the things that we do with our body, speech, and mind. All of our emotional and mental problems that create suffering. And so, you know, it's not like we're bad, but I know about you, but I've noticed a few habits floating around that might not be beneficial to all beings and that keep me from hearing, you know, seeing and acting, devoting myself fully to a deep aspiration to heal the world, myself included. And so I think it's interesting to study, you know, that's maybe it's old language or terminology, I could stop right here and talk for hours about what a taint and defilement is, but I think I'd like to zoom forward to 21st century relationship and our lives. So I'll get back to that. So before even being able to hear the perfect wisdom of the Buddhas, which, you know, is readily available, the gentle Buddhas too. I would like that translation, gentle Buddhas. Before we have a chance of even being able to listen to that, there's some house cleaning that might need to be done, or at least attentiveness to some of the pain that we carry. And then it says, taught for the wheel of the world, W-E-A-L. So that's kind of an old word that kind of means well-being, benefit, for the common wheel, for the benefit. I also think it's interesting because wheel is sometimes parsed as a wound, right? A oozing wound. Yeah. And then it goes on to say, for heroic spirits intended. And often in Mahayana literature, at least, that I've seen, heroic spirits or heroic beings, so this is another term for bodhisattvas, you know, for people devoted. But it's a heroic kind of quest we're on, that constant cycling of calling forth our deepest intentions and a willingness to put down or let go of all of the things that make us feel good about ourselves. You know, like, I'm this way. I'm better than that person, or I'm this way or that way, or I. You know, that's what a defilement is. It's something that's, you know, protecting this idea of self that will do anything to survive. So we have to be very gentle to that part of ourselves. And people have been talking lately about, you know, listening as a really wonderful practice. I think Laurel gave a wonderful talk on that. And Douglas spoke recently on, you know, kind of working with habits and patterns and how Zazen helps us see our habits and patterns. But I don't think that this process of purification, of observing ways in which we get in the way of ourselves and others is exclusive to Buddhism 2,000 years ago. In my life, I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I've been impressed at the ways that psychology has given us hints about how to practice with relationship to create harmony and peace and connection. So, I'm going to zoom forward after kind of laying this very early, amazing, you know, that's just how the Prajnaparamita Sutras begin. So that's probably enough teaching for me for a lifetime. Those words, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect and faith. Remove all the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. And listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the wheel of the world, for heroic spirits intended. However, in the spirit of that, I thought I'd offer just a little bit about a man named John Gottman. I don't know if anybody's heard of John Gottman. Nobody here has been in couples therapy, probably. But John Gottman is a famous psychologist and researcher. So he's a clinical psychologist, but also a researcher. And he and his wife live in Seattle. And they, his life's work has been observing human relationship. And he began a long time ago thinking, I'm not very good at relationships. I'm not always that good with my friends. And this was probably before his second divorce, but probably during his first. And he's like, you know, what's up? Like, what keeps me from doing this in the way that's good? So Gottman videotaped, and I remember when I was in graduate school, which is many a moon ago, videotaped hundreds of couples and interviewed couples all over the place. He was at U of I in Champaign-Urbana, and he would talk to farmers, and they're, you know, male and female farmers, I guess, or farmers and farmer wife. And, you know, when he first went out to interview people, because he's like, you know, how did you meet? What went on? How do you make this thing work? Or how is it? And why isn't it working? And very curious man. But it was interesting because at first when his research assistants would go out to talk to some of these people down in Southern Illinois who were not affiliated with the university, you know, they would be like, it's fine. Not bad. But what's it like? Okay. So he thought, how am I going to get these people to open up? And he listened. He remembered. He said, you know, there was this guy, Studs Terkel. Anybody know who Studs Terkel is? I mean, what a name, right? Studs. So Studs Terkel, now dead, but he used to live around the corner from me in Uptown when I was a younger person. Studs was this geezer who, actually, he has a law degree from the University of Chicago, but after he finished school, he decided that he wanted to be a hotel concierge because he loved talking to people. And he's famous. He's a famous radical, kind of, you know, I guess communist, socialist type. But he had a radio program in Chicago and he wrote books called Working. He was a champion of humanity in all of its... So he would interview people on the radio and he celebrated the working class when nobody else was paying attention to them and social movements. But he was a huge talker, but a very engaged listener. He would get people to talk about anything from all walks of life. Does anybody remember this? Do you remember that, David? Because you were from Chicago, right? Laurel, I mean, you know, a lot of y'all probably heard of Studs. But, and so Gottman listened to Studs and adopted his way of interacting with people to get his research assistants to talk to couples. And that's a little bit of a diversion. But I just think, like, there's bodhisattvas everywhere running around doing their thing, teaching us. And Gottman found, so he videotaped couples and started to look at and study their interactions and categorize them. And looked at really unhappy couples and really happy couples. He also was interested in friendships. And I think his work applies to any relationship. Because, you know, probably nobody can push our buttons better than someone we're really close to. Like, really intimate with. Like, maybe your spouse or your family or your brother or sister or... your bestest friend, you know. So this is where some of our stuff comes out, right? Some of our defilements, our obstructive defilements, or our taints, I would say. Some of our tendencies to want to be like, I'm right and you're wrong. Let's do it my way, you know, like Frank Sinatra. So I wanted to share a few tidbits from Gottman. So one of the things he found, he looked at what he called these masters and disasters of romantic relationship. And one of the things he found was that people who are unhappy are in a state with each other, are in a state that he calls negative sentiment override. So everything that person does upsets them. And is proof that that person is a dud. You know, do you ever have that? Like, you know, all of a sudden somebody like can't, everything they do is proof. When, you know, 6 months before, everything they did was wonderful. This often happens in love, right? You know, like, And so he also found this opposite thing, that couples who could get through very difficult times had this thing going on called positive sentiment override, where everything the other person did was so cute. Like a baby, you know, it can give you this poopy diaper, and you're like, I'm so glad your biology works, you know? Where, you know, your romantic partner might fart, and you're like, you're just a pig. You know, so, I mean, this is the kind of thing that Gottman was studying and saw. And he also saw that there were reactive patterns, interactional patterns, that are what he called, now this is great, he called them the poisons. He also called them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the death of relationships. And to me, this is the kind of thing that Buddhist practice can help us study in ourselves. Of course, none of us probably ever do any of these things, but you probably have heard of them or seen other people do them, so you can be really helpful. So the poisons, or he also called them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the death of relationship. But, you know, poisons is a traditional word in Buddhism that's used for greed, hate, and delusion, right? The three poisons. Gottman found four. And Gottman also, interestingly, had antidotes to those poisons. And in Buddhism, we actually look at the poisons and their antidotes. We also look at the hindrances, like the five hindrances. You've probably heard of those. And their antidotes. So I found it kind of interesting that the way in which he talked about these things, even though he's a man of the conservative Jewish faith, and he has a strong faith, I thought it was interesting. So the first one of these, if you can imagine this, criticism. So when you criticize someone you love, you basically are like implying something's wrong with them, right? You know, you did that. And, you know, all of a sudden, instead of a problem being between you and me or a difficulty, it's located, like, in this other person, you know, embodying that in their body, right? And often criticism takes the form of things like what? You always do that. You know, you never tell me you love me. Things like that. Now, usually when people hear something like that, right, what happens? Somebody says, you never do anything wrong. You know, you just hit that bell wrong. Well, the Eno didn't tell me how to do that right, right? You know, once I was in a Zen situation in a kitchen, not at this wonderful Sangha, but in another wonderful Sangha. And there was a huge war between the head of the kitchen and their assistant cook, head of the kitchen. And I was like chopping vegetables, and somebody would come along and go, who told you to chop those vegetables that way? What's wrong? And I'd be like, so-and-so, and they're like, oh, do it this way. And the other person, so I was like constantly just, what do? You know? So this is the kind of thing, right? Quite poisonous. Now, sometimes people, we need to give feedback and talk to each other about things that we are not comfortable with or whatever. But the antidote to criticism that Gottman has, and he calls it the soft startup. And it's speaking gently and clearly from your own position, right? This is kind of basic, good speech. But it's not always that easy to do when we're not happy. So Zazen helps us to stabilize ourselves and to meet situations in an upright way. And even to know when we get off balance a little bit. You know, so we can talk about things that are difficult, maybe, and not have it be a all-out nuclear war on someone. And, you know, I say this is used with romantic partners, but this can be used at work, right? This kind of stuff operates, you know, it can even operate in a Buddhist sangha. Who knows? So criticism is the first poison, the first horse in the apocalypse, horseman. So that, of course, comes leads right into what's another one. When you feel criticized, we tend to feel defensive. So it's like, you know, we perceive attack. Somebody might say, well, it hurt my feelings. And it's like, I didn't mean that. Not me. I mean, I didn't know, you know. Or, you're always criticizing me. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't mean to, but you're too sad all the time, or something like that. So this is the kind of thing where when we get defensive or, you know, want to avoid taking responsibility in an interaction. So, you know, Buddhism is a radical form of inclusivity. Like, everybody's included. You know, so that kind of inclusivity isn't seeing my position and your position are different positions. It's like, oh, wait a minute. I just saw separation there. I got defensive. So, you know, there's an antidote to defensiveness, of course, which is to say, oh, to hear someone's complaint about me with love and respect and faith and take some responsibility for my role. Yeah, maybe I did do that. I once was speaking about something, and I knew when I was talking, when the words came out of my mouth, that they weren't quite right, that they might hurt someone. But I just like thought, I want to get on to the next thing I wanted to say. And later someone came up to me and said, were you aware when you were speaking that you said something in a way that might have hurt someone? And I said, thank you. You know what? I realized that and I didn't even stop myself. Because I couldn't slow down enough. So there's something in practice about this stopping in the name of love to slow ourselves down before what? We break our hearts?
Yes.
If that's all. Is there time? Not bad. Okay. There's a lot there. And I don't think I was grateful in that interaction when I felt like, thank you, Buddha, to help me appreciate someone helping me to take responsibility for something unskillful in a very kind way. So that's often very nice, like when you're giving somebody, quote, feedback. Usually somebody says, I want to give you some feedback. They're not saying, oh, you did a great job. Usually, you know, like, when we never do that. Like, I always think, when, next time I give feedback to somebody, I want to do it. That was great. But, you know, so usually you kind of know, oh, something's coming, right? So you can feel it in your physical body. And there's resistance, right? And kind of a wobbling. I don't want to take that. So, you know, there's this amazing benefit of practice to kind of soften us up and remind us that all that fear that, and, you know, whatever is if we're trying to protect around self, you know, we don't have to do that. Because it doesn't even exist. That's the great teaching of the Heart Sutra, right? That little tiny self nugget is kind of a figment of our imagination. So is this Dharma talk. Maybe just talk about one more of these horsemen. The third one. And that's one that is considered to be the most destructive, and what happens when people are in this negative sentiment override, when everything someone else does is proof that they're a less than kind of individual. You know, one of the Buddha's teachings is to treat all beings as equal. So meet all beings as equal. Equal to each other and equal to this other being. And there's sometimes this kind of like situation happens where contempt is some kind of statement or nonverbal behavior that puts yourself on a little bit of a higher ground, right? Like a sneer. It's a devaluation. And it can be mocking someone, calling them names, you know, rolling eyes, avoiding often like really coming close. And the reversal of contempt is actually appreciation. You know, giving value, but the sense of appreciation of love and respect and of faith that even if I things aren't going the way I think they should go, that it's all really, it's all okay. And so you could say, you know, there's this old literature in Buddhism of like wholesome and unwholesome qualities to cultivate or root out. You know, there's like tear out, remove, you know, that's, those are used. But actually, those tendencies are extremely pervasive in my experience of humans, including starting with myself. And so, you know, how to cultivate and kind of, you know, extract those and then use them in ways that bring us to harmony, you know, and manifestation of what I think all of us know deep down is the truth. You know, anybody who's felt love, you know, for a flower or a baby or a humanoid, knows that truth. And there's pain when we can't express that fully. And there's a kind of, you know, a covering, you know, in the ancient Buddhist literature, they think of these things that are like covering our ability to see reality and to see wisdom. In Buddha's enlightenment, one of the first things he was supposed to have said was, I now fully see that all sentient beings are endowed with the virtues and wisdom of the enlightened ones, but because of their mental and emotional problems, they can't see it. They don't even see how, we don't even see how wonderful things are. So maybe like, you know, the death of Ron Kidd, I was filled with appreciation for what he brought to this world. And in many ways, he was someone who almost always encouraged me to appreciate the world. He was a very kind person, and I felt he could really listen and be present with people as a teacher in a very soft and open way. So anyway, that's just a tidbit of a free association that I had to the great opening lines of the Ratnaguna Samchaya Prajnaparamita Sutta. So thank you very much for listening to this, and I really appreciate your responses and experiences with these kinds of practices. Lisa, bring it on.
Just to say thank you very much, very helpful to look at basic relationships, both the love that can be there and also that which gets in the way, so mm-hmm. practical. But comments, questions, responses, Rohit. Yes, Kish.
Thank you for bringing up Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel. And I just this week read an interview he did with James Baldwin, and I was just reminded of how brilliant he was. He said, "So Jim," which I love that just for starters, "what's it like to be a gay black poet?" And he got such good answers. I mean, he just spoke the truth and waited for the truth, and people responded. And I think we could, I love it that the person you're telling us about, who I never heard of, John Gottman, learned from him. I think he's a teacher we can all benefit from, so thank you for the reminder. But it's not fair to say there were four poisons and only told us three of them. I think we're all wondering what the fourth was.
Yeah, the other one. Okay. I didn't mean to withhold that tidbit.
Withholding, is that the fourth?
Yeah. Almost. Good, yes. So we'll let that horse out of the gate. It is stonewalling or withdrawing. So, like, you know how, like, you might, like, start, like, going, la, 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 when somebody is saying something you don't want to hear. So you can check out internally, or you can just, like, walk away and be like, you know, whatever. That's, so that's also, what's interesting, very interesting about this one is that from Gottman's research, he actually would hook people up to, still does actually, still alive and teaching wildly, I mean, continually, and continually refining his work. But he would hook people up to pulse oximeters, which measure heart rate and oxygen consumption. And he would find that when people were overwhelmed, like their heart rate, they'd be sitting there talking, and then all of a sudden there'd be a little difficult interaction. And one or both partners would shut down, but their heart rates were through the roof and their oxygen consumption was lower because they're not breathing enough because they're so tense, right? So, and you found when this happens, there's nothing you can do. Do you ever have that? Like when you're so upset, like somebody's talking at you and you're just both like repeating the same thing, but it never goes anywhere. That is a state of diffuse physiological arousal, so that you have to calm down, right? Shamatha, calming, right? Insight is seeing into something, and that takes some energy, like to see into my own delusion. You know, that'll put me in diffuse physiological arousal quickly. But the calming, and so the calming that's needed is like on the order of at least a half an hour without assistance. So usually people are like, oh, I want to come back and prove my point back to you. But they're still hyper-aroused physiologically, and that has impact on how we're processing information neurologically. So nothing get through. So that withdrawal is actually kind of a good thing. The person needs to withdraw and calm down, but it also leaves the other person, you know, kind of abandoned, and often things never go anywhere. People just go in the opposite direction and nothing shifts. So people have to kind of calm down. So calming down is another one of the things that Gottman actually encourages people to cultivate. And when I've trained extensively with him and his wife, his third wife, and they've been married 20 years and they seem extremely happy. But there was an exercise where we were working with stonewalling, and they go around and they watch you do therapy, right? So I'm the therapist, and this person, this couple's like doing this, you know, they're stonewalling, they're in diffuse physiological arousal. And I said, okay, well, let's just take a minute now to calm down and breathe. And I go through this kind of thing and they're like, wow. Like, you're really good at that calming you know, helping people through that. Well, you know, I'm a Zen Buddhist priest, and they're like, oh, okay. you're all very good at this. But it's interesting that that's that stopping in the name of love, right? Like if we stop and really slow down, and it's a hard thing to do, but actually we need to. So I think Buddhist, instructions, I mean, the very first thing, you know, he really did on his path to enlightenment was to sit down for a week and tolerate. He had the ability to tolerate somebody in his face, you know, this Mara business, but somebody in your face all the time. And, once you can do that, yeah, it's pretty good. So that's the fourth one, Laura. Thank you for asking. Yes.
Yes, thank you, Hogen. So when you mentioned his name, it meant nothing to me. But as you began speaking about him, I think that Malcolm Gladwell wrote about him in one of his books. And if I recall correctly, Dr. Gottman has the uncanny ability of predicting whether a couple is going to get a divorce or not based on the 15-minute interviews that he takes on video, because he stops frame by frame.
That's right.
And analyzes how many times the husband rolls the eyes.
Right. That's
right. Or how many times the wife, you know, says something right. Passive-aggressive. And I've kind of always been curious to, like, submit myself and Susanna to this test and see if we can master it. But then perhaps...
He's looking for couples, actually. Go on his website. I just saw they're soliciting for a study.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah.
But
correct. Yeah.
Beyond this, I guess, my response, I really appreciated how you brought our awareness to the power of words. Mm-hmm. And what we do with words.
Yes.
And I don't know where I read this, but I think sound advice, when you're in a fight, if what you're about to say is going to feel good, don't say it. And I like to think of words as actual objects that mm-hmm. we put out every time yes. we speak, you know, as little pieces of verbal matter, but matter mm-hmm. nevertheless. And I think that, you know, talking about contempt and criticism and the opposite of appreciation really sheds light on the power of these objects that we construct all the time and share with the world without really being aware of the weight that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of the radioactivity of some. You know, some are unstable elements, some are pretty dangerous and heavy. But that's great, yeah. So do you know which book of Malcolm Gladwell's that was in? Because, I mean, Blank or something like
Blank.
That. Yeah.
It was Blank, because it's about snap mm-hmm. judgments and perceptions. And mm-hmm. I think Gladwell talks about Gottman in terms of, you know, how good he has become mm-hmm. at reading the microchips that happen
right.
in a human's face.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two people, actually. There's Paul Ekman and John yes. Gottman. And Ekman, actually... And Gottman, I mean, they know each other. And they both are some of my favorites because I think they're both maybe the most accomplished living psychologists of our time. And Ekman studied facial expression of emotions because emotions are hardwired in our faces and there are certain muscles in the face that correspond to one of the six affects or emotions. And so Gottman can read those. Ekman studied it tremendously. What actually the four horsemen, Gottman says that the four horsemen appear at a certain rate in the first 15 minutes of his interview with people. And he doesn't say that. He has data like there's a 70% chance that that relationship will end. Something high like that. It's not 100%. But that pointing out how, and this is the Buddhist practice, right? Buddha was an empiricist. You know, close mm-hmm. observation of our experience. This is what Buddhist psychology is. This is what these defilements and kleshas, as well as these wholesome states and factors of enlightenment, we watch. How do those arise? What keeps them going? And how are they transformed? You know, because actually... It's the transformation of this very negativity, the greater the mud, the greater the Buddha. When we with our practices, we transform ourselves physiologically. So those, the weight of those words, of our body, speech, and mind, that's shifted by stopping, appreciating, gratitude, love, respect, loving kindness, all those wholesome factors, joy, buoyancy, openness, pliancy. Those are classic. So thank you very much for pointing that out. Yes.
I was thinking about how you're speaking about these in relation to, well, in terms of our relationships with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about how they apply in terms of self-awareness, especially in sitting, but throughout the day, as we might have an opportunity to come to awareness about something internally.
Yeah.
And how we use the same horsemen in response to those moments. It might be defensiveness, or it might be self-blame. You're always like that, you need it. Or it might be checking out. Whatever we do, it's the internal relationship as well, it seems like.
That's a great, great point. And I think that if we're doing it outside, we're definitely doing it inside. No inside, outside, or in between, as we say.
It's sitting in a great place to observe that dynamic, exactly. Those dynamics happening.
Yep. Yeah. And also to transform them.
Right.
So openness, non-judgmental, appreciation. So you can actually appreciate internally, like that inner bully, or inner, you know, like, when negative sentiment override, when nothing you do is ever good enough. Another name in Buddhism for that is negative self-clinging. So you can let that go and say, whoa. Because you're creating this negative self, right? Then you've got this other self that's really knows best, right? So that's another part of you that says, you garbage, you know? So yeah, there's all this kind of, it's totally applicable.
Yeah, it's really what's challenging about sustained zazen practice is not just, you know, not some pain in our knees, but seeing this stuff, which, you know, to use a word, a global word for all of what you're talking about. I don't think just seeing it is enough, though, because we have to, some things you can see and let go, but some things never go away, or they just get subtler. And so what's really challenging is to see that negative clinging and you know, or contempt, inward or outward. And so I really appreciate your talk tonight, because it's illuminating some of the dynamics of how we can not just see how we're obstructing ourselves, but also see ways of working with that. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much.
We should stop now
and for time for
tea.
Let's close with the four bodhisattva vows.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. The delusions are inexhaustible. Delusions are inexhaustible.